It's great to have you back.
You're making headlines everywhere. Good morning, Wolfgang, by the way. You're making headlines everywhere because you've probably seen that Dr. Robert Malone, the inventor of the mRNA technique, vaccine technique, has quoted you repeatedly because finally, he says, and this is true for many others as well, finally, it is becoming very clear that the psychological backdrop is the only explanation for what is happening. Without this psychological terror, that's what I would call it, this whole thing would not have been possible. Have you gotten many calls from other people who want to interview you and want you to explain this?
Yes. I receive every day, I don't know exactly how many, but I receive many requests for podcasts and interviews, yes. And it's very nice to be here again. I want
Thank
to say
you.
That to begin with. Yes. Indeed, Robert Malone referred to me at the Joe Rogan podcast, mm-hmm. and he summarized my theory in a concise way, mm-hmm. Using the term mass formation psychosis. Yeah. And actually, I never used that term myself. Okay. I always use the term mass formation.
Yeah.
Because in one way or another, I prefer that term. Both from an ethical and a pragmatic and an intellectual perspective, to me it seems to be a little bit problematic to use the term psychosis. I know many people now, the term is trending now, mass formation psychosis, but still I will continue to talk about mass formation.
Mm. So I was wondering, because you said, you know, like in this sort of hypnotic state that a lot of people are in right now, what is your feeling? At what point are we now? Also with regard to the totalitarian system, you know, with like that it's starting to eat its own children, basically. Like where are we at the moment?
Well, it's maybe hard to say at what stage we are exactly, but it's clear that the process of mass formation and totalitarian thinking is going further and further, I think, in this respect, for instance, that we've seen the introduction of the Corona Safe Ticket or of the QR code as a condition to enter certain parts of public space. It's becoming clear already that even, Vivian, of Dr. Fisher, you referred to the monster that devours its own children, but indeed, it's clear at the moment that even the people who buy into the narrative or who want to identify with the system, who go along with the system, will fall prey to the system, and because also they have to be tested. Also, for them, they are not free again after two jabs. The restrictions and the limitations continue to have a devastating impact, I think, on the lives of everyone. Not only the people who refuse to go along with the system. So, and that's exactly one of the illusions that people have when mass formation or in particular totalitarian thinking emerges in a society. The illusion is that if as long as you go along with the system, as long as you identify with the system, you will be safe or you won't end up in troubles. But that's not true at all. That's exactly the difference between a totalitarian state and a classical dictatorship. In a classical dictatorship, this might be true, but it's not true at all in a totalitarian state. In a totalitarian state, as soon as you understand the dynamics that are going on, you realize that there is only one safe, or there is only one real option, and it is to defy the mass formation. And to do this in a specific way, to begin with, you have to speak out as long as it is possible to a certain extent. And also you have to demonstrate in public space. You have to demonstrate according to the principles of non-violent resistance. That's something that is extremely important because in a classical dictatorship, for instance, to compare it again with a classical dictatorship, non-violent resistance doesn't make sense. a classical dictator at a psychological level has his impact and he has his grip on society because people are scared of him because of his aggressive potential. And he will use his aggressive potential as a reaction to nonviolent resistance. But as soon as you enter a state mechanism, which is much more imperialistic or even more totalitarian in nature, then the psychological process is completely different. And in that case, nonviolent resistance is what is most effective. And also from what has to be preferred from an ethical point of view, of course. And you can understand that very perfectly well. I won't explain the mechanism of, or at least unless you want to, but I won't explain the entire mechanism of mass formation again. But if you remember well, the fourth condition, which is extremely important of mass formation, is this enormous potential of free-floating frustration and aggression. And as soon as the opposition uses violence, then the mass will consider this a justification to direct all this frustration and aggression at the dissonant voice. Because that's typically what, at the psychological level, unconsciously, the masses need. They have this frustration and aggression, and they always seek for an object to direct this frustration and aggression at, and to manifest something that is extremely typical for the crowd or the mass, and it is their inclination to commit atrocities as if it is a holy duty to commit them, as if they need to do so for the sake of the collective, for the sake of the masses themselves. So from this perspective, as soon as you're dealing with mass formation or totalitarian thinking, you need to be firm and you need to organize well-organized non-violent resistance in which speaking out is the first and most important act.
Can we just, so that those viewers who have heard about you but don't exactly know what these four elements are, that on which this mass formation feeds, can you just quickly go through them again? The most important one, you just mentioned it, yes.
Yes, I can. Mm-hmm. So indeed, mass formation is as exists as long as humankind exists. I mean, it's a specific type of group formation in which people actually lose all capacity for critical thinking and in which they, very important, start to think all exactly the same. That's something extremely strange. They start to have, to use the same words even, they start to function the same and they lose their capacity for critical thinking and also their intelligence. And that applies equally well to highly intelligent as to less intelligent people. So phenomenon of mass formation in a nutshell. And then, but large scale mass formation occurs or emerges only when the population is in a very specific state. And a state which can be characterized by four conditions. And the first condition is that many people, that's the most crucial one, many people have to feel socially isolated or have to be in a state of social atomization, as Hannah Arendt said. So, and we saw now just before the corona crisis that this most crucial condition was definitely fulfilled. For instance, a Gallup World Poll, the US Surgeon General in America, observed a loneliness epidemic in the States in 2017, I believe. More than 50% of the people mentioned that they had no meaningful contact at all. And yes, that they only connected to other people through the internet. Mm. And then in the United States, a minister of loneliness was appointed by Theresa May. Wow. Because she also acknowledged the proportions of the problem, and it's clear that this social isolation is correlated highly with the level of industrialization and the use of technology in a country. Mm. And that's exactly why the process of mass formation, because this most crucial condition increased, the number of people who felt socially isolated increases constantly since three centuries, since the scientific mechanist, materialist view on man and the world became dominant since the world got industrialized and since the technology, first radio and television, and then the internet were used more and more. More and more people felt socially isolated and more people became vulnerable for mass formation. And that's why in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th century, this radically new type of state, the totalitarian state, emerged for the first time. We should not forget that. Totalitarianism is a relatively new phenomenon. It did not exist before the 20th century. It started to exist at the moment the masses became so powerful that they were the most powerful group in society. At that moment, totalitarian states emerged and totalitarian regimes emerged. And to come back to these four conditions for mass formation, well, the first and most important is social isolation. Many people have to feel socially isolated, have to experience a lack of social bond. The second one is that many people have to feel a lack of meaning-making and sense-making in life. The third one is that there has to be high levels of free-floating anxiety, which means anxiety that cannot be connected to a mental representation. So people have to feel anxious without knowing why they feel anxious or what they feel anxious of. And then the fourth condition is that there have to be high levels of so-called free-floating frustration and aggression. And all these four conditions are nicely connected to each other. So as soon as people experience a lack of social bond, being social beings, they will also experience a lack of meaning-making. And if someone experiences lack of social bond and lack of meaning-making, they will experience usually this typical type of anxiety, which is free-floating anxiety, and they will get frustrated and aggressive. And if then, under these conditions, a narrative is distributed through the mass media, and very important, it has to be pronounced with the mouth, it has to be articulated, then a narrative that indicates an object of anxiety and at the same time provides a strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, then something typical might happen. All this free-floating anxiety in society might connect to this representation of the object of anxiety in the narrative. And because people want mental control over their anxiety, they might be willing to participate in very far-going, extreme strategies to deal with the object of anxiety. Okay, mm-hmm. For instance, the lockdowns to control a virus. And then, once this happens, something even more important happens. A new kind of social bond emerges, and that's crucial. So, because many people participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, they fight a heroic collective battle, and a new kind of solidarity emerges. And that's the most important thing, this new kind of solidarity. If you don't want to get vaccinated, or if you don't wear a mask, people will reproach you typically that you show no solidarity, no citizenship. So that's the most important thing to realize. And this new kind of social bond, this new kind of social bond is a very specific kind of social bond. It is not a social bond between individuals. It is a social bond between an individual and the collective. And the more the process of mass formation continues, the further it progresses, the more all the ties, all the bonds between the individuals are destroyed or disrupted. That's crucial. And that's typically what happens in a totalitarian state. In the end, there is a completely paranoid atmosphere in which every social bond between individuals is disrupted, destroyed, while the bond between the individual and the system is getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And sometimes this happens. This can be provoked, or this can be pursued in an intentional way, this destruction of the social bond between the individuals. For instance, in the Soviet Union, this happened in an intentional way. In Germany, Nazi Germany, it happens in a spontaneous way. And that's always the big question. To what extent does the process of mass formation and totalitarian thinking happen in a spontaneous way, or to what extent is it intentionally provoked? Usually, and that's not my level of expertise, that's much more your level of expertise, usually it is a mixture between the two. The process of mass formation has always existed, and it sometimes emerged in a completely spontaneous way. But I believe that as soon as it leads to really a totalitarian state, there has to be at least, and it's, I'm sure of that, there is a certain institutions and certain individuals who see the opportunities that are provided by the mass formation or by the sensitivity for mass formation, and they start to use it to a certain extent to promote their own ideology and to increase their grip on society, to reshape society according to their own ideology. For instance, the technocratic or the transhumanist ideology. So it means that, in their opinion, very often they believe that they do the only thing that can really solve the problems of the world, like climate change and other stuff, and that at this moment or it were other problems in the beginning of the 21st century. But of course, they are so fanatically convinced that their ideology is the only solution. And of course, they like to believe it because they see themselves as the people who will be in charge in this new society. But anyway, so it's usually the emergence of this mass formation is usually a very highly complex and dynamical phenomenon. So, but once it emerges, it creates this new social bond, this, and then it leads to a certain, that makes, that it leads to a certain mental intoxication. It makes people switch from a highly negative mental state in which they felt socially isolated, the lack of meaning making, a lot of free-floating anxiety and a lot of free-floating frustration and aggression, to exactly the opposite, to a state in which they are maximally connected in a crowd, in which they experience a new kind of meaning making, all very symptomatic, of course, but anyway, they experience a new kind of meaning making. All their anxiety is connected to an object, and all their frustration and aggression can be directed, aimed at a scapegoat, namely the people who, for one way or another, defy the masses or refuse to go along with the masses or cannot go along with the masses for certain reasons. So it is this switch from a highly negative to a positive mental state, which leads to a certain mental intoxication and which leads to a narrowing of the field of attention, and which makes that people only see what is indicated by the narrative and makes them completely insensitive for all the arguments that are situated outside this field of attention. And, well, in this way, we end up in this problematic state that no matter how absurd the measures become, it won't make a difference. Even to the contrary, for a certain part of the population who is really into this process of mass formation, usually about 30%, the more absurd the measures come, the more they will be applauded. Because for these people, and that's only a minority, or at least it's not the major part of society, for these people, the measures function as a ritual which is a symbolic behavior that always have specific characteristics. Rituals are a kind of behavior that has no pragmatic meaning, that is absurd from a pragmatic point of view, and that demands a sacrifice of the individual through which the individual shows that the collective is more important than its individual interests. Okay? So, and that's why the measures, no matter how absurd they become, for a certain part of the population, there will absolutely be no reason to question the narrative or to go against it.
Well, I mean, that's really interesting. I think I understood even better now, like, yeah, some things, you know, that you said, like, before. You know, like, when I think, like, in my family, there's one person that has always lived very withdrawn, you know, but I think this person suffered also a little bit, you know, or, like, I guess quite a bit from being so secluded, is that the word? You know, like living just by him or herself and in isolation, sort of, you know. But now this being in isolation is actually like has become the absolute right thing to do. It's the healthy thing, it's the good thing. So it's basically, you know, this isolation that was a pain has now been become sort of a sacrifice, something good that you give. Like it's the, you know, that's very interesting. So I can understand that maybe this mental state of the person, the emotional state, it has created a completely new, you know, attitude toward this really problematic, socially problematic situation that was there before. Mm. That's, yeah. And another thing, like, I mean, this absurdity, you know, that's one thing that I find also really interesting. So you say the more flamboyant, basically, these rituals become, you know, the more exaggerated, like if they wanted to ask us to wear like a red head or come in like in red clothing, like every day to show that you have the right kind of attitude, or like, and then cut off maybe your finger or something. I mean, to show that you have, that you're of the right mentality, that would even make sense for them because it's like this bond. It's this social bond that you are part of the good crowd, of course, basically.
Of course. And the problem is not that people need rituals or they want rituals, because people are symbolic beings and people are in need of certain rituals, I believe. But the problem is that people are no longer, because of their materialist, mechanist view on man and the world, they are no longer aware that they perform rituals. They believe that their rituals have a pragmatic necessity. And that's the problem. As long as a human being realizes that his behavior is ritualistic in nature, I believe he will have the common sense to more or less limit the impact of the rituals on his daily life or on his welfare, on his health, and so on. But if people believe that the ritual he is performing, or he or she is performing, has a practical necessity, then there is no limit to the sacrifice he wants to bring for the collective. And that's one of the tragedies, I believe, of the totalitarian system. That's one of the reasons. You can explain it in much more ways, but one of the reasons why mass formation and totalitarianism are always intrinsically self-destructive. They are always intrinsically self-destructive because they perform rituals that are not recognized as such.
That's funny. I have always despised any kind of rituals. I once made a huge mistake and joined the army. I enlisted for 12 years. After about a year, I understood everything they're doing are empty rituals. They make no sense. That's why I never really, I was a member of the church here in Germany, of the, in Northern Germany, of the evangelists. But I left them because one reason is taxes, and the other is, again, empty rituals. Because to me, all of these rituals had absolutely no meaning. It's just, all of these rituals, the ones that I experienced, all of them seem to only be designed to make people follow orders. And I hate that. But it does seem, from your explanations, it does seem that some people need this because they don't seem to be able to make their own choices and their own decisions. They need someone to tell them what to do. And it seems like rituals are one vehicle for making people do the things that they otherwise wouldn't do, right?
I'm not entirely sure about that. Sometimes rituals are used for that as an instrument of power. Mm-hmm. I also believe that sometimes they give expression to the identity of someone. And it depends, of course. The ritual, there are many sorts of rituals. But indeed, very often, they will probably be used as a way to make a subject show, voluntary or involuntary, that it belongs to a group. And, you know, I believe that in itself, the problem is not that there are groups and that people belong to groups and that people sacrifice a little bit of their freedom for the group, because I believe that society that can Or if people want to live a life worthy of a human being, I believe there has to be a balance between individual freedom and the collective. I believe that the individual has to realize that it has to sacrifice a little bit of his freedom for the collective, and the collective has to realize that the its function is exactly to give individuals the opportunity to live a free life. So, and as long as there is a balance between the two, I believe, in my opinion, my humble opinion, I believe that there is a possibility that the society can be really humane, and that people can live a life worthy of a human being. That's what I believe. There has to be a balance. But the drama of totalitarianism, the problem of totalitarianism, is that it starts first from a state of extreme individualism, in which an individual has the feeling to be completely socially isolated and to belong to no group at all, which is a terrible feeling for most human beings. And then suddenly it switches to the extreme opposite, in which the collective is radically more important and also possesses the individual at the mental level completely, which is the condition, the state of mass formation, and in which the individual, strangely enough, is not really connected to the other individuals. It does not give rise, the mass formation does not make that there are new connections between the individuals. Mass formation makes that the individual is absolutely connected with the collective, with the masses itself. And that's why the totalitarian state does not allow any other real relationship unless the relationship between the individual and the state. And that's why, for instance, George Orwell said, the first victim of the totalitarian state is always love. the love between people. Yes.
So it's basically some sort of hive mind, or like a Borg kind of constellation, you know, that people are in at the moment. So basically a very good preparation for a transhumanist agenda, if you wanted to look at it that way.
Well, yes, I believe that, I also believe that the basic ideology that is seizing power now in society is the technocratic and the transhumanist ideology, which is, in my humble opinion, dehumanizing in nature, as all totalitarianism is. And I mean this in a technical sense, dehumanizing, because the essence of humanity and of the human being is, in my opinion, a certain space in which an individual can make individual choices and has a certain freedom. And that's only logical because as no theory is complete, every subject should be allowed the freedom to invent its own theory from which it wants to organize its life and its existence. And that's exactly what a totalitarian system refuses to an individual. A totalitarian system believes that its theory, the theory of the state, is total, that it has no lack, and that as a consequence, that it should impose its way of thinking and its theory to all the individuals without leaving them any space to make their own choices. And that the essence of humanity is exactly that we exist as a human being, as a subject, at every moment when we make choices that are really our own choices, that cannot be reduced to the other or to the state or to no matter whom. So that's the moment where humanity as a phenomenon emerges. And if a state denies this space to its individuals, then it is really dehumanizing in a technical, psychological sense. Is it dehumanizing? And that's what happens, I believe, in a technocratic state where people believe that the technocratic mechanist, materialist knowledge of an expert is superior to all other types of knowledge. That's exactly, then it is by definition dehumanizing in nature. And that's, I believe, the big risk, the major risk that is associated to transhumanism and all technocratic thinking.
Wolfgang, you wanted to say something?
Yes, thank you. Hello.
Hi, Wolfgang.
I'm very fond of what you said. And I think there is a problem because there are so many possibilities to make choices every day, each day, that we have to build our own rituals. We know we have a breakfast, we know we walk, we have a walk in the afternoon. Such people have their own rituals, and they are individually choices. Those rituals they choose individually. And so there are those both longings. There's a longing for freedom and the longing for simplicity, that life doesn't get too complicated. Mm-hmm. And I think they just use it. And if you make such things as they did with us now with the so-called pandemic, they just destroyed our normal rituals. They forbid our normal rituals. They separated us from all we have chosen before, to how we wanted to live. And then they had this vacuum. They made us insane. They made us uncertain. They made us anxious. And they just use this to implant new rituals. And so we are longing for new rituals because our old rituals are not allowed anymore. I think this is a very, very effective trick they use.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I don't know if they... I always feel a little bit hesitant to see it in a too intentional way. In this sense that I believe that we were anxious because as a consequence, human beings have always been anxious, and sometimes it is exploited and abused by people who want to use that anxiety to impose their own ideology or to get a firmer grip on us. So it can be a little bit of the two, I believe. But I definitely agree that we all constantly participate in rituals. We construct rituals every day, I think. But what you bring up is, I think, extremely important to make the difference between ritual that is constitutive for humanity and a ritual that destroys humanity. Yes. I mean, if you allow individuals to choose their own rituals, at least to a certain extent, because a ritual is always something that is shared with others as well, I think, mm-hmm. but it needs to be, you have to, the other has to allow you to be creative at the level of your rituals. And that's where you start to exist as an individual. And if the state constantly tries to destroy that the own creative input at the level of the construction of the rituals, then the state becomes an enemy of humanity.
If you regard all those Sunday rituals people have in sports or with their cars, with their hobbies, where they meet, and there are groups of people, they have the same rituals, and they are happy to do this ritual with the others together. Mm. And so I think it's you're right when you say we have the choice whether we go fishing each Sunday or whether we go running each Sunday or so. It's our ritual, and we establish it, and it makes life easier because we get accustomed to it. We don't have to think every Sunday, what do I do now? So it's make life easier, and we need this simplifying our life because it would be too much, those decisions we could have. And but I think this is something the constitutional thing of our political, of the political life too. It's the human dignity. It's the question. And the human dignity is just that we are allowed to have choices. And we are all equal in the right to have choices, but we are all different at the same time with our choices. Mm. And to have this balance between those two things, I think it's very important. This is what we should strive for. And I think this there is one thing which is very interesting. It is when you have different societies. So you have neighbors. For instance, we have the neighbors in Denmark, or we have the Czech Republic or so, or in Poland, and they have different rituals. But the borders are opening, and we go traveling. We make holidays in different societies. So now we experience that different societies react differently with this problem we are facing. Some people are more anxious, others are not, and they change their life, and others, they don't change it so much. Some societies believe their politicians. They do what the politicians say, like in Sweden. They are used to trust them. And in other societies, people are not used to trust the politicians or the police or so, because they're corrupt. They used to be corrupt. And so now suddenly we observe that in those societies which are corrupt, which used to be corrupt, there's more freedom than in those societies where the people used to obey. I think it's a funny phenomenon for me. And we could perhaps learn something from this, but I don't know what. So perhaps you could help us.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the first thing that totalitarian states tend to do is limiting the capacity for people to travel.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, to replace themselves. Yeah. Yes.
I always it's difficult for globalists to do this.
It is. Yes.
Can I ask you something? I remember, or do you want to say something more?
Go ahead. Yeah.
You know, I remember that you said that, you know, to break through this hypnosis, that this is a very hard thing to do, because basically only the one who started the hypnosis, like, for instance, the politicians, the media or something, would be, I mean, the sort of the authorities to basically end the whole thing, just like the magician, you know, says, boom, now it's over, wake up, everyone. So, but what we can see, like, you know, we get also a lot of information from, like, the hospitals. And so I just got word that in a larger hospital, a lot of the doctors have started to vaccinate their relatives themselves, or like their colleagues, meaning they're not doing it because they have now come to doubt the whole thing. So they're not doing it anymore. Maybe some got vaccinated, but now they, for the children or like for the second or third dose, they don't want to do it. So they've, you know, they venture out into like not doing this ritual. So, but they're still hiding, or like they're not showing their faces, you know, they're not speaking out, even if they see so many like side effects, you know, that's why they are now going into that direction, to avoid the vaccination for their closest relatives and maybe their friends and whatever. But they're still afraid to speak out. So what is something, you know, kind of the final push, where could we help in order to sort of push them over the,
edge,
like, so that they really come out with their faces? Because, you know, that's the thing. If there was like a 1,000 doctors, say, I think the Charité has like 17,000 employees or something like that. So if like 1,000 people, 500 people would speak out at the same time. Yeah. And I mean, maybe that's the same is true for Munich or whatever, large hospitals, you know, then what could they do? So, but they're still, I mean, they're thinking of their careers, and they, to some extent, they still don't want to, you know, accept that this is, has been like a whole, like, dark narrative that's been fed to them.
Yes, I know. You know, I believe that the choice to speak out or not is one of these fundamental choices of a human being, yeah, on which you cannot have too much impact. I always notice that in my clinical practice as well. You can lead a horse to the water, but you cannot make it drink. It is sometimes said. And you can help a patient you can reassure him and encourage him to speak out, even be it only about himself in the therapeutic space. But whether he really does it or not, you cannot decide for him. And that's maybe also the nice thing, because that choice to speak out or not is what most of all defines us. That's the most defining choice a human being can make. To speak out, to say in public space what he believes is true. Not because he is sure that what he will say is the absolute truth or something, but just because at that moment he has the feeling that this is what is true and that this is what he should say. That's the most fundamental act that a human being can do, in that way, it's the most defining act. It's the core of our being. As when we stop to do that, we lose our soul. That's written in the Talmud, I believe. And it's good that nobody else can make this choice for us, and that we do not have too much impact on this choice in another human being, because it's everybody's choice. Its own choice, really its own choice to do it or not. So I believe we can try to lead the horses to the water, yes, try to continue to speak out ourselves in an as sincere and honest way as possible. But I'm afraid that we only can hope that more people will speak out, but that we have to accept if they don't do so. At least that is what I try to do, because I have the feeling that if you try to force someone to speak out, you always have the opposite effect. Yeah. You always have the effect that they close down more. And if they speak out, it's not really the truth that they say. Yeah. They tell what you... Well, so in that respect, I believe we have at the same time to do our utmost best to create a space in which people find the courage to speak out, and at the same time to perfectly accept if they don't do it.
So either you have it in you or you don't. You can't push anyone. As you said, you can lead the horse to the water, but you cannot make it drink. Some of us will speak out, some of us won't. There's two more questions that I have. One deals with the self-destructive element, the intrinsic self-destructive element of totalitarianism, and the other one deals with what I, as a lawyer, am trying to do, find those who are responsible. But the first question is, can you define why this is intrinsically bound to be self-destructive, totalitarianism? Is it as simple as the revolution devours its own children? Because as soon as you've done what you're supposed to do, you're not needed anymore. Or if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're also not needed anymore. Is it as simple as that?
I think just saying that the revolution devours its own children is a description of the intrinsic self-destructiveness. Mm-hmm. Of totalitarianism or of mass formation, but it's not an explanation. And I think you can explain it from many different perspectives, I think, but none of them is very easy, but I will try to present one of these perspectives. Yeah. You know, so the emergence of a mass happens on the basis of these four conditions we've been discussing. And it's clear that a mass wants to continue to exist because it provides this new social bond, the bond between the individual and the collective. But it knows that it can only exist if there is an object of anxiety. One, it always has to have an object of anxiety. And two, the object of anxiety always has to be destroyed, stigmatized, marginalized, and so on. Because there is this fourth condition, which says that there is a huge potential of frustration and aggression in the masses, and it constantly has to satisfy this aggression, to direct it at an external object. So this leads to this very specific phenomenological characteristic of mass formation and totalitarianism, that one, it always seeks an object of anxiety. Read Orwell, read the history of the Soviet Union, and you will see it. It always needs a new object of anxiety. Which it then needs to destroy. And that, in the beginning, the choice of the object of anxiety is more or less logical when you consider it from the perspective of the ideology. For instance, it was more or less logical from a materialist historical materialism, that it was the aristocracy that had to be destroyed in the Soviet Union. But after the aristocracy came the large farmers. That was also more or less logical. Then the small farmers. That was already less logical. Then the goldsmiths. And then the one group after the other, until Stalin, in a completely nonsensical way, until Stalin eliminated 50% of his own loyal party members. So that's the process of mass formation in action. It defines an object of anxiety. It tries to eliminate it, silence it, sometimes destroy it. And then it continues with always new object of anxiety until everything is destroyed or until the equilibrium of the system balances, tips in another way. So, and it is this process, if you want to keep the destruction within certain limits, you have to continue to speak out. That's the point. Mm-hmm. The atrocities become more extreme as there are less dissonant voices. And that's perfectly logical as well, because the phenomenon of mass formation is a phenomenon of hypnosis. And hypnosis is always provoked by the articulated voice of someone, a narrative that is articulated. And so that explains both at the same time the intrinsic self-destructiveness of the process of mass formation and totalitarianism, and what the solution is if you do not want to go along with the masses, if you want to defy the masses, if you want to stay outside of the masses, then it is an illusion that you better go underground. No, you have to remain in public space as much as possible and to speak out.
And, but can I ask you, like, they could now become much more aggressive in the sense that they just like do random aggressive stuff. Like, I mean, of course, it's a very aggressive thing to force people with the masks and like, you know, do this forced vaccination or like, you know, what's coming or vaccination mandates, you know. But do you think they're also like, since it's, I think it's kind of a fragile system also. I mean, this social engineered mass, I mean, as I see it, you know, and at the same time, what's how they react. It's like it's a balance kind of, so you cannot push too far. So if we stay all peaceful, do you think in order to fulfill the need for more aggression, do you think they would really, is it very likely that they kind of soon switch to more aggressive behavior from their own side, you know, like come up with more false flags? And I mean, we see that with these walks, these demonstrations, there are more agents emerged, you know, that are trying to provoke a little bit. But so far, it has not been successful. I mean, do you think they're looking for some stuff where they can hop on with their, you know, aggressive police force or something like that? Or do you think they would like really go for other aggressive activities like themselves?
Some of the leaders might try to use more aggression, even if the opposition sticks to the principles of nonviolent behavior. But I doubt whether they will find social support for it. That's one of the problems. Like if you look at Macron in French, who used this terrible phrase that he wanted to how do you say it in English? He wanted to make the life of the unvaccinated people completely impossible and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He didn't find much social support, and it worked rather contrary to him. And that's because the masses always want to be in the conviction that they live for a certain holy duty for the collective. They are usually, I don't think it will work very well now. Mm-hmm. Things has also changed. The zeitgeist has changed, mm-hmm, compared to the first half of the 21st century, which is very much to our advantage, I believe. Mm-hmm. That's something that Hannah Arendt already remarked. The new totalitarianism will not be led by gang members, but it will be led by dull bureaucrats and technocrats, she said. And that was because she was perfectly aware that the zeitgeist was changing, and that overt aggression was no longer something that was part of the idealized fiction of the population. So, in my opinion, from several angles, I believe that even if the leaders would choose to do so or would try to do so, overt aggression against people who stick to the principles of nonviolent resistance will not be very successful, I believe. Mm-hmm. But what will be successful is the stigmatization and the marginalization of those who do not want to comply. That will be effective. Mm-hmm. I think, Niels Bohr said, prediction is always difficult, in particular if it is about the future. And it's, of course, that's true. Nobody knows exactly how things will evolve. But my two-cent-word opinion would be that they might succeed in marginalizing and stigmatizing the people who do not want to go along with the system even more than happens now. That might be successful, But I don't think that large-scale attempts at physical destruction of the opposition will happen or will find enough social support to really be realized. That's what I think.
I think this is a very good thing to have in mind, because there are some persons like famous people and from sports, or famous people from the movies, and so, and where people are used to think they're heroes, and when they are also marginalized, I think there will be some resistance, because it's difficult to change the switch here. Suddenly a hero is marginalized. What's that? And people, I think this is, so they are very important, those former heroes. It would be very important that they show up and that they stay, that they stay powerful and that they are courageous.
Indeed.
I think this would be good.
But I want to say something. I think they have a problem here, because the thing is, since they're limiting, you know, the expiration date for the vaccinated, you know, all the time. So everyone.
Can you come again?
The vaccination, the status as being vaccinated, has an expiration date,
and I think
that is a major problem. If it was like this one time vaccination thing, so everyone who hasn't done it is like, you know, is the one that's up for grabs for being like marginalized and stigmatized. But basically, even if you comply, you know, that's, I mean, they need this constant pressure to be kept alive, you know, but you, next thing you see, like 6 months later, 3 months later, your status has expired, and now you're yourself in the problematic situation that you are out of the system. And I think that's, you know, that's also making a lot of people angry and starting to question the thing. So I think they have a sort of a dilemma going on.
Yeah, this is another perfect example of how this is self-destructive, because sooner or later, everyone will catch on, except maybe for the 30% that you mentioned. One final question before we let you go. As a lawyer, we always look for culpability. We always try to find those who are really responsible. In my view, those who are behind the psychological terror are, of course, responsible, because they're the ones who invented all this. But you said halfway through our interview that it is a mix of what we're seeing here. This totalitarianism is a mix of what we witnessed in the Soviet Union. It was intentionally done, and what developed more or less on its own in Germany. And I think it's probably true that we, once again, we're witnessing a mix of both. But there's some people in this who are pushing it and others who are playing along, either because they have personal advantages, either because they get paid for it, or they have other advantages, a political career or a career in the media, whatever. How can you tell? How can you tell who is culpable in the legal sense? I mean, criminal law is very simple, in my view, at least. The civil law actions, which will definitely follow for damages, that's much more complicated. But criminal law, all you need is an act. Somebody dies because of that. This act, somebody shoots at a person, this person is dead. Then the second level on which you discuss criminal law is there a defense? Is there self-defense, for example? Justification is what this is called. Well, there's no self-defense issue here. There's no justification. And the third level then is there an issue with actual culpability, insanity, for example? This is where most of the criminal cases that are discussed in the general public, this is where they really play out. Because it's usually easy to see somebody killed somebody, and it's easy to see if you kill a child, this cannot really be self-defense. So this all plays out on the exculpation, on the insanity defense in many cases. How can we ultimately see who is going to be responsible because they wanted this to happen and they were capable of controlling themselves, because insanity means you either don't know what you're doing or you can't control what you're doing. How can we tell this? I mean, quite obviously, this is to me the most important question. Quite obviously, those people who are behind this, who wrote the panic paper, for example, of course, in my view, but I'm just a lawyer, in my view, these are psychopaths. But that doesn't mean that they're not culpable. How do you see this?
Well, you know, in my naive opinion, I would start with a quote of Freud, if I want to answer your question. Mm-hmm. Freud said, you're responsible for your own unconscious, he said. by which he meant that it's not because you do something unconsciously that you're not responsible for it. In a psychological and in a judicial way, I believe. So, in my opinion, the first question is, who transgressed ethical rules mm-hmm. in this situation? Who transgressed the eternal rules of humanity? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's always the most important question. I believe everybody can justify why he transgressed certain ethical rules, and we can take that into account if we determine how he should be punished or not. But it's no excuse. It's not, for instance, it's not because when someone is hypnotized, he usually will stick to the same ethical rules mm-hmm. as the ones he sticks to when he is awake. Mm-hmm. So that means, I believe, that being in a mass or being under hypnosis or being in the hypnosis of being a leader of the mass will sometimes be an excuse mm-hmm. to manifest your unethical tendencies, but it will not mean, but it will never push you over ethical boundaries that you want to stick to when you are awake or when you are in a normal state. And I believe that very often the same holds for insane people, although there is a limit there. Mm-hmm. But in that case, if someone is really in a state that we usually refer to as a psychosis, in which he becomes the passive object of his own drives and of his own instincts, sometimes that happens. Mm-hmm. But in that case, it's very clear that the person is in an extremely specific and unique state, which becomes clear of all the rest of his behavior as well. So I don't believe that most people, if there are people here who try to do unethical things in this crisis, I don't believe that they will be in such a state, or at least then it should have become clear to everybody who was around them, and they should be able to describe the wider psychological function of that person in a very detailed way. But usually, if someone is in such a psychotic state, he does not function at all anymore, and he shows very specific deficits in his functioning, which are clear to everybody.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. The insanity excuse only works for people who either don't know what they're doing or who cannot control their impulses. There are several rules, both here in Germany and in the United States. We have the McNaughton rule, we have the irresistible impulse test, we have the Durham test or New Hampshire test. But this is not what we're dealing with here. This is really, what you're saying brings us right back to the Nuremberg trials, because that is how they were resolved, how these trials were resolved. Most of the people who were ultimately sentenced pulled out the defense of, I just followed orders. And that is precisely how they were then defeated, or how this defense was defeated, because ultimately, this is what you just said. You talked about the eternal rules. What this really is an innate feeling or an innate capacity to tell right from wrong, to tell good from evil. So if you as a soldier get the order, kill these children, you know You cannot and must not follow this order. So this is what this harkens back to. You know precisely what you're doing. You can control what you're doing. And that's what you're saying. You have this innate capacity to tell right from wrong. That's why this is not excused. And that's why this is not in any way justified. Thank you very much, Matthias. This was extremely
Thank you for inviting me again. It was nice to be here again.
Yeah, and same here. We'll be back. Thank you, Matthias, and have a great weekend.
Bye.
Okay.